He's above the law. He's too powerful. Nothing can stop him. The courts and the media have given up. We're too divided to beat him.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
That's the same story from every country that slipped into dictatorship. But that's not America. There is a powerful force that can stop Trump.
Democracy is who we are.
It's you. It's your vote and your voice.
This is one of those defining moments in American history. Each of those who vote will be remembered. So let's love good. Let's get back to work.
This year, it's America or Trump. And America's counting on you.
Wow. That's a lot of pressure. That Lincoln Project, boy, those Republicans are dramatic, ain't they? They're good at that.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No,
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. To the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, so the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We've got quite a few items of news for change and various odds and ends I want to try to get to as we head into our spring break here. But frankly, Desi Doyen, hi.
Hi.
As we head into summer, we're getting a lot of ominous signs on what may be in store as we've sort of been smashing through both land and sea heat temperatures consistently now, month after month after month, for much of the past year.
Yeah, it should be noted that every day the global ocean average temperature has hit a new record for that day, every day for the last year.
And it has sort of left climate scientists sort of scratching their heads trying to figure out how things have gotten so bad so much more quickly than they anticipated it would. So much more quickly than the climate models that they've been relying on for years had suggested. Gavin Schmidt, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute, issued one of the warnings in the journal Nature this week, as he writes, "When I took over as the director of NASA's Goddard Institute, I inherited a project that tracks temperature changes since 1880. Using this trove of data," he says, "I've made climate predictions at the start of every year since 2016. It's humbling," he says, "and a bit worrying to admit that no year has confounded climate scientists' predictive capabilities more than 2023 has. For the past 9 months," he notes, "mean land and sea surface temperatures have overshot previous records each month. by up to 0.2 Celsius, a huge margin at the planetary scale. A general warming trend is expected because of rising greenhouse gas emissions, but this sudden heat spike greatly exceeds predictions made by statistical climate models that rely on past observations. Many reasons for this discrepancy, he says, have been proposed, but as yet, no combination of them has been able to reconcile our theories with what has happened. In other words, the globe over the past year has suddenly become much hotter than scientists had even predicted that it would based on their climate modeling using decades of data, and they now admit they don't actually know why it has gotten so much warmer than they had predicted and what exactly is, you know, the explanation for it. Much of that warming we've been trying to bring to your attention over the past year, particularly on our Green News reports. As Schmidt explains and details some of the stuff we've covered, he notes starting last March, so now a year ago at this point, sea surface temperatures in the North Atlantic Ocean began to shoot up. By June, the extent of sea ice around Antarctica was by far the lowest on record. Compared with the average ice cover between 1981 and 2010, a patch of sea ice roughly the size of Alaska was missing. And that's a lot of sea missing sea ice. Yes. Alaska is huge. Just to offer some perspective here, Alaska is larger in surface size than the areas of both Texas and California combined. So more than that, that's how much ice is, for some reason, missing. The observed temperature anomaly, he says, has not only been much larger than expected, but also started showing up several months before the onset of El Nino. Now, El Nino has caused the Pacific Ocean temperatures to warm, and that would be expected to warm things up globally in overall, but the spike in warming, if I'm understanding this, began before this year's, last year's El Nino set in the second part of last year. So, no, El Nino on its own cannot explain this disturbing spike. Am I explaining this correctly? Am I understanding this, Desi Doyen, correctly?
It matches with my understanding that there is this gap in knowledge and they're finding different aspects of what could contribute to it, but none of them actually add up to what the observations are showing.
Schmidt goes on to describe a few things that could account for some of the extra warming, though more data is required to confirm that and those things. But he notes that for now, scientists cannot currently explain this unprecedented temperature anomaly that we are now experiencing. I say it's an anomaly. I hope it's an anomaly. He then goes on to note, in general, the 2023 temperature anomaly has come out of the blue, revealing an unprecedented knowledge gap, perhaps for the first time since about 40 years ago when satellite data began offering modelers and an unparalleled real-time view of Earth's climate system. If the anomaly does not stabilize by August, he notes, a reasonable expectation based on previous El Nino events, which is when things should start to calm down. But if it doesn't, then the world, he says, will be in uncharted territory. It could imply that a warming planet is already fundamentally altering how the climate system operates much sooner than scientists had anticipated. It could also mean that statistical inferences based on past events are less reliable than we thought. Yeah, get it right, scientists. but in this case, and it's kind of a case that I've also been warning about for years, that the scientists could be lowballing it and that there is evidence that they are lowballing it and that it could end up being much worse or much more soon than we had expected. Much of the world's climate is driven by intricate long-distance links, notes Schmidt, fueled by sea and atmospheric currents. If their behavior is now in flux or markedly diverging from previous observations, we need to know about such changes in real time. He says we need answers for why 2023 turned out to be the warmest year in possibly the past 100,000 years. And we need them quickly. Yes, we do. As Desi has been reporting on Green News Report, these temperature spikes around the globe in both land and sea temperatures, in addition to resulting in a much warmer and snow-free winter than usual here in the U.S., which could lead to water problems, by the way, in the coming months, are resulting in droughts around the world. And, Des, as you note in today's GNR a little bit later, temperatures like those seen in South America this past week, where Rio de Janeiro in Brazil hit a heat index of 144 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yes, to be clear, we're not talking about the actual temperature. It's the heat index. That's the combined feels-like temperature of heat and humidity together. Yeah, 144 degrees Fahrenheit. Very, very scary temperatures.
Yeah, I should say so. That, by the way, as the Biden administration implements some long-overdue new standards for vehicles and light trucks, emissions standards, which will hopefully speed our transition toward electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles, even as the CEO of Exxon, which spent years spending millions of dollars to lie to the public about global warming, costing us billions of dollars in damages and deaths, that CEO announced that it wasn't his company that's responsible for climate change in any way. It's you people who buy their products. Anyway, more on all of that in our latest GNR a little bit later today. Meanwhile, in addition to what is being described as the EPA's biggest climate measure ever regarding vehicle emissions, the Biden administration is continuing its broad efforts to help those who have been buried by student loans, thanks to unethical private companies and colleges, schools, profiting off of federal student loans and years of mismanagement of these loan programs. President Joe Biden on Thursday announced yet another additional round of student loan debt forgiveness, this one totaling $5.8 billion for nearly 78,000 public service workers who were originally told that their debt would be forgiven previously, only to be misguided or just frankly lied to about it by some of these horrible private corporations that have been allowed to administer these public loan programs. The president will reportedly be sending congratulatory emails to those newly forgiven borrowers next week. Additionally, 380,000 borrowers who may be eligible for debt relief within the next year or two will also be getting emails from Biden being told about it with a message to keep it up. Quote, "I hope you continue the important work of serving your community," the message says. "If you continue your career in public service, you're on track to get your eligible student loans forgiven in less than 2 years through the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program." That, according to an example email that will be sent out to some of those who are not being immediately forgiven, but will in the next year or two, under the program known as Public Service Loan Forgiveness, or PSLF, qualifying borrowers like teachers, social workers, some nurses, doctors, even some government lawyers are eligible for student debt cancellation after making 10 years of monthly payments. That's how it was supposed to work. President Biden said in a statement that these public service workers have dedicated their careers to serving their communities, but because of past administrative failures, never got the relief that they were entitled to under the law. Congress created the this program, the PSLF, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, back in 2007, where if you, you know, perform public service for a number of years, you should have your loans forgiven. But rigid rules and what the AP here generously describes as missteps by student loan servicers left many borrowers unable to get the cancellation that they were promised. The Biden administration loosened some of the rules in response and retroactively gave many borrowers credit toward their 10 years of payment after many of those borrowers were shuffled into so-called forbearance programs by these companies, but not told that months or years even in that program would not count against their 10 years of service, public service, and their years of payment. PSLF was created by Congress in 2007, but was plagued with problems long before Biden took office. Just 7,000 people had ever received debt relief under this program previously, according to the White House, despite hundreds of thousands of people signing up, thinking that, you know, 10 years later, their debt would be forgiven. It wasn't. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona on Thursday said today more than 100 times more borrowers are now eligible for PSLF than there were at the beginning of the administration. The emails come as the Biden administration is eager to remind voters in an election year about how it has approved more student debt cancellation than any other president, notes CNN. That despite the fact that the Supreme Court blocked its broad student loan forgiveness program last year, ruling that the Biden administration could not modify loan agreements, even though they were undone under the very same federal law that the Trump administration did so, if in their case only temporarily during the worst of the COVID pandemic. The program that was blocked by Trump's corrupted right-wing Supreme Court under Biden would have canceled up to $20,000 for low and middle-income borrowers for an estimated total of $430 billion of debt relief. Instead, the Biden administration has now canceled a total of $144 billion of federal student loan debt for nearly 4 million borrowers to date, mostly through existing student loan forgiveness programs that target specific groups of borrowers, including a program for borrowers who have been misled by their colleges.
Yeah, it's really, I would love to underscore that this student loan debt forgiveness, especially this latest round, is to right wrongs that were done to the borrowers, that were done to the students, to right those wrongs, especially here, like with public service workers like firefighters and teachers who actually keep our cities running. And it's definitely needed, and I hope people understand that this is to right wrongs.
Well, they were the sort of reviewing these people who are now being forgiven happened because borrowers were inappropriately steered by their student loan servicing companies into these long-term forbearance programs
that didn't count toward their actual
forgiveness. And they were not told. They were not told that that period would not count against their time toward forgiveness, or that they would be, by the way, charged interest for all of those months that they were told they didn't have to make payments. The borrower defense to repay program to repayment program delivers relief to those borrowers who were actually defrauded by their colleges, for example. The Biden administration also made discharges automatic for borrowers who are totally and permanently disabled. Additionally, nearly 153,000 borrowers have been granted forgiveness so far under Biden's new income-driven repayment program known as SAVE. Under that plan, remaining federal student loan balances are erased for those who originally borrowed $12,000 or less and have made payments for at least 10 years, even those who are not in public service jobs. None of these programs expire, meaning that they will help qualifying borrowers now and in the future, unless, of course, a different president decides to come in and somehow cancel them. You know, after years of complaints being made by folks on Fox News, for example, that these programs are somehow giveaways.
They're not.
Even after these borrowers have been misled by their schools, by their government, by their private companies administering these loans, these, for-profit companies. So, a lot is riding on this year's election, from the climate to these, to these people who have been ripped off, who have been told one thing. Anyway, some more news today along similar lines, perhaps. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Thursday that a Major Israeli ground assault on the southern Gaza town of Rafah would be a, quote, mistake and unnecessary to defeating Hamas, underscoring the further souring relations between the U.S. and Israel. Blinken, on his sixth urgent Mideast mission since the war began, spoke after huddling with top Arab diplomats in Cairo for discussions over efforts for a ceasefire and over ideas for Gaza's post-conflict future. He said an immediate, quote, an immediate sustained ceasefire with the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas was urgently needed, and that gaps were narrowing in indirect negotiations that U.S., Egypt, and Qatar have spent weeks mediating. So that call for a sustained ceasefire is being regarded by some as a noteworthy change in the administration's rhetoric here. After previously calling for a temporary ceasefire, now they would like to see a sustained ceasefire. Blinken said the administration is putting forward a National Security Council resolution in support of these efforts.
There's a clear consensus around a number of shared priorities. First, the need for an immediate, sustained ceasefire with the release of hostages. That would create space to surge more humanitarian assistance, to relieve the suffering of many people, and to build something more enduring. We've been working, as you know, with Egypt, with Qatar, and with Israel to put a strong proposal on the table. Hamas responded to that. The negotiators continue to work. The gaps are narrowing, and we're continuing to push for an agreement in Doha. There's still difficult work to get there, but I continue to believe it's possible. The United States has also put forward the United Nations Security Council resolution to support these efforts, and we hope that all countries will back that resolution. Second, there's an agreement, as you heard from Minister Shoukry, on the urgent need to surge and sustain humanitarian assistance for the people of Gaza. Children should not be dying of malnutrition in Gaza or anywhere else for that matter. 100% of the population of Gaza is experiencing severe levels of acute food insecurity. We cannot, we must not allow that to continue.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Cairo on Thursday. He now heads to Israel on Friday to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet. The growing disagreements between Netanyahu and President Biden over the prosecution of the war will likely overshadow those talks, particularly over Netanyahu's determination to launch a ground assault on Rafah in the south of Gaza, where more than a million Palestinians have sought refuge from devastating Israeli ground and airstrikes further north. Netanyahu has said that without an invasion of Rafah, Israel can't achieve its goal of destroying Hamas after its deadly October 7 attack and taking of hostages that triggered Israel's bombardment and its offensive in Gaza. But Blinken said at the news conference in Cairo, a major military operation in Rafah would be a mistake, something that we do not support. He was very clear about that, and he said it's also necessary, yes, to deal with Hamas, but not like this. On a roughly 45-minute call, on the other hand, with Republican senators on Wednesday, Netanyahu, the far-right Israeli prime minister, pledged to ignore warnings about a Rafah operation. He took aim at Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's condemnation last week of the civilian death toll in Gaza and his call for new elections in Israel, even after Schumer, the nation's highest-ranking elected Jewish official representing the world's largest Jewish community in the world, in New York City, even though Schumer has long been an ardent supporter of Israel. Nonetheless, apparently he's now to be attacked for having an opinion by Benjamin Netanyahu. President Biden praised Schumer's remarks, by the way, calling for new elections in Israel on the Senate floor last week. Netanyahu's vow to go into Rafah has alarmed the U.S. and others who say it will result in an even larger humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, without a credible plan in place to protect civilians, to somehow get them out of there. U.S. officials have said that they have yet to see such a plan, and they are prepared to continue offering alternatives to an all-out assault on the city. Now, I may have some time to get to some related-ish thoughts a bit later today, but because most coverage of this story and related stories on Netanyahu's horrific assault on Gaza keep failing to mention it, I feel like I must take note of this, that Netanyahu is facing numerous felony charges in Israel, which cannot be brought against him while he remains in the position of prime minister. And yet, he has also said that he would not call for new elections in Israel, which would likely result in him being removed from office.
And going to jail.
Until the war, in response to the October 7 attacks, has ended. So, no new elections until the war has ended, and he can't be removed until there's new elections, which means that the idea that Netanyahu, frankly, would ever end this war on his own, that's unlikely to ever happen, as long as he needs to stay in office in order to stay out of prison. And that, of course, is a very analogous situation to the need for one of Netanyahu's biggest supporters, that would be Donald J. Trump, to get back into office, to also avoid accountability for nearly 90 felony charges. That is the election that we face in this country, one between accountable democracy and lawless autocracy. Or frankly, to put it more simply, America versus MAGA. We've got several items of note, news of note along that front today as well, and which hopefully translates these news items, hopefully translate into good news for America and accountable democracy, but we will see. That news and Trump accountability news, particularly in New York, and more, is all straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman, and thank you for tuning in to the broadcast.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
It's up to you, New York, New York.
Yeah, looks like it might be. If we want any accountability at all before November, but we shall see. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We'll get to some New York stories in a moment, but President Biden's campaign continues to boast a significant cash advantage over Donald Trump's. That, according to new campaign finance disclosures on Wednesday, as the disgraced former and perhaps future president juggles fundraising for his bid to return to office while trying to pay his mounting legal bills now 7 months before the most critical presidential election this nation has arguably ever faced. Federal Election Commission reports filed on Wednesday revealed a clear fundraising advantage for the Biden campaign over the Trump campaign, reporting $71 million in cash on hand for Biden compared to Trump's $33.5 million. Sad trombone. I don't have that clip set up, but that's what I would play. That's what's playing in my head. Anyway, that would be Biden with more than double the size of Trump's reserves. Biden's campaign widened the gap from the end of January, when it led Trump's campaign $56 million to $30.5 million. The report underscores the extent to which Trump's legal troubles are now putting a strain on his campaign, even as his legal troubles are pretty much all that he is now running on. But that $38 million advantage that the Biden campaign has over the Trump campaign might have been completely erased had Trump not had to spend well over $50 million in campaign funds on his legal woes last year, mostly wasted on ridiculous claims, silly motions. Well, I shouldn't say it's wasted because he's been able to push off a lot of this.
Yeah, he has succeeded in the kind of delay that he needs.
Moreover, Save America PAC, the political action committee that the Trump campaign has been using to pay the bulk of his legal bills, and those of many of his associates, by the way, they spent more than they raised in February, with the vast majority of its spending going to, yes, legal costs. So there's your fiscal conservatism for you, by the way. Trump's PAC is spending more than it's actually taking in. The Save America PAC reported about $4 million in cash on hand at the end of February. It spent about $7 million over the same period, including more than $5.5 million to lawyers. Since the start of this year, Save America has spent $8.5 million on legal bills.
Make lawyers great again.
The make lawyers rich again,
yes.
I guess. Though Biden has trailed Trump in many of the early national and battleground state polls, the incumbent's campaign and allied groups are outpacing Trump's efforts in fundraising and the cash stockpiled for the general election. The Biden campaign said it ended February with $155 million in the bank across all of its allied groups, and that it raised money from nearly 500,000 donors. That's a lot of small ticket donors to that campaign. The team also said it raised $53 million in February alone across all five of the entities that are fundraising for the president's efforts, including the DNC. On Wednesday, meanwhile, the RNC reported that it had raised $10.7 million in February and ended with a little over $11 million in cash on hand, while the DNC raised more than $16.5 million in that same month. So a little over $10 million raised by the RNC, a little over $16 million raised by the DNC, and they reported more than double the cash on hand with $26.6 million in the bank at the end of the month compared to the RNC's $11.3 million. It's a good thing I didn't have that sad trombone clip because I would have been playing it a lot during this story. Even though it's kind of gross that we, in this country, we're judging, the relative success of political campaigns based on how many millions of dollars they have. But guess what? You go to war with the rules that you have,
yes.
Basically.
And listen, I mean, it is very important. These kinds of things take funding. It takes funding to organize in communities to help people get registered and to help them get out to vote and understand what the stakes are. It takes money to counter Republican disinformation and, some of those slimy, sleazy ads that the Republicans will be putting out. I mean, you have to counter what is out there. If you don't, then the disinformation just spreads, and there's no counter to that. That takes money.
The Biden team launched, in fact, $30 million on a spring advertising campaign in key swing states, including ads aimed at Latino voters, trying to shore that up. The campaign has said it will open more than 100 offices this month, and Biden launched a national organizing program to engage Hispanic voters in Arizona this week. The Democrats mocked the fundraising disparity between the two parties on Wednesday, with Biden's campaign communications director saying in a statement, quote, "If Donald Trump put up these kinds of numbers on The Apprentice, he'd fire himself." At the same time, the New York Attorney General is preparing to take away whatever money or property that Trump himself, along with his company and his two eldest sons, might have had laying around to help pay off the nearly $500 million that Trump is now on the hook for in New York, following years of massive bank, tax, and insurance fraud there. And he's going to have to come up with that money in some fashion very quickly. The New York Attorney General's office, according to CNN Today, has already filed judgments in Westchester County, the first indication that the state is preparing to try and seize Donald Trump's golf course and private estate north of Manhattan, the one that's known as Seven Springs that Trump has been lying about for years. State lawyers entered the judgments with the clerk's office in Westchester County on March 6, just 1 week after Judge Arthur Engoron had made official his $464 million decision against Trump, his sons Don Jr. and Eric, and the Trump Organization itself. Entering a judgment is the first step that a creditor would take to attempt to recover property. Additional steps, such as putting liens on assets or moving to foreclose on properties or take action against or take other actions in court, that would apparently follow if the asset is going to be seized. So filing the judgment is a landmark. It's not the whole thing, but it's a landmark, and it sort of shows the Attorney General's hand as far as what she plans on doing. A judgment has already been entered in New York City, where Trump's properties, including Trump Tower, his penthouse at Trump Tower, his 40 Wall Street skyscraper, his hotel abutting Central Park, and numerous apartment buildings are all located, all of which could be seized beginning as early as Monday, March 25, if Trump is unable to secure a bond for the money that he now owes New York for years of massive real estate fraud.
It would be interesting to see how this would play out if Attorney General James decides to seize those properties, especially in New York. I would be surprised if she showed up with police officers and a padlock, because that, I think, would give Trump the kind of theatrics that he needs in order mm-hmm. to say, look, I'm being victimized.
Well, yeah, but she can go after his bank accounts.
Yes, he has other options.
Accounts.
There were some people who thought, oh, that'll be great TV. It's like, I don't think that would be the kind of great TV that would actually be very helpful to getting justice done.
We'll see. It might be great TV. Judgments, CNN notes in their report, have not yet, at least not yet, been entered in Florida counties, according to CNN, including Miami or Palm Beach County, where Trump's Mar-a-Lago property and the Trump National Doral Golf Club and Resort are located. That Mar-a-Lago property, which he said in one of his filings could be worth more than $2.6 billion, even though the Palm Beach County assessor said it's worth $18 million. Neither has she filed judgments in Cook County, Illinois, where Trump's hotel in Chicago is located. That, according to a review of the records as of Thursday. In yet another social media posting, however, on Thursday, more signs that Trump is now just in an absolute panic about all of this, justifiably. Trump said that putting up the money is, quote, in all caps, very expensive. Yeah. And he said that, quote, it is, quote, not possible for bonding companies to do in such a high amount. Which is not true. It actually is quite possible. They're just choosing not to do it with Donald Trump, since he's not really reliable. But, you know, perhaps he should have thought about all of this before he committed fraud in such a high amount. While Nikos Passas, a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Northeastern University, said that going after properties can be complicated, the New York Attorney General, quote, could also obtain bank levies and go after the bank assets. She could put liens on properties. There are all kinds of things that she'd be able to do in an effort to collect, as you suggest might be better, Des. Passa said, in the end, I think this could very much mean the end of Trump business in New York, and not only, he said. It could spell trouble in other jurisdictions, too. So sad. On Thursday, the trial judge overseeing the case, Judge Arthur Engoron, expanded the role of the monitor overseeing the Trump Organization to include more expansive oversight of Trump's real estate businesses and their internal financial practices. And now, as I read that, This is now meant to make sure that Trump does not try to pull off any trickery by moving the ownership of properties around, moving money around, and so forth. And Goron also ordered the Trump Organization to supply detailed information to the Monitor about its efforts to obtain bonds to cover these judgments. According to the judge's order, quote, the Trump Organization shall inform the Monitor in advance of any efforts to secure surety bonds, including any financial disclosures requested or required, any information provided in response to such requests, any representations made by Trump Organization in connection with securing such bonds, any personal guarantees made by any of the defendants, and any obligations of the Trump Organization required by the surety. That's the entity that would be putting up the bond or bonds on behalf of Trump. Judge Engoron laid out a timeline of certain steps the Trumps must take within the next month, including providing the Monitor, that would be retired Judge Barbara Jones, with full access to its day-to-day financial operations. Engoron also empowered the Monitor to have copies of the Trump Organization's monthly bank and brokerage statements. So the state learns exactly what he and or the company actually have, all of which could be seized by the AG, and that they should be notified in advance of any transfers above $5 million. Those must be provided along with information about the creation or dissolution of business entities. Again, they must inform the Monitor in advance of all of this and of any debt financing.
Yes. So in other words, Judge Engoron is closing off all of the avenues that Trump could use to cheat.
He is being squeezed, and he is being squeezed hard by New York to pay them, you know, what he owes them.
Because they know the tricks that he can pull.
And this is just the civil stuff. While his criminal trial related to hush money payments made just before the 2016 election to help him cheat to win that election, that trial was supposed to begin on March 25. That's now been delayed by a few weeks, but March 25 is also now the day that Trump must either pay up nearly $500 million or come up with a bond to cover that amount, unless he's able to get some sort of accommodation from the state appeals court. But he would have to do that in very short order. As to that briefly postponed criminal trial in New York, however, which is expected to get back on track by April, well, we've got some bad news there as well for the disgraced former president. So sad. As Jennifer Rubin reports at Washington Post, New York judge's ruling on evidence in that criminal trial couldn't have gone worse for Trump.
Oof.
Sad trombone there, too, I guess. Four-time indicted former president Donald Trump, Rubin reports, suffered arguably his worst losses in any criminal matter this week when, in his New York trial for alleged falsification of business records related to the $130,000 in hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniel via Trump's then attorney, now opponent, Michael Cohen, in New York State, the criminal judge in New York, Judge Juan Merchan, ruled against Trump in virtually all of his motions to exclude evidence. By contrast, the judge largely granted Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's motions to exclude evidence for trial that Trump believed might be exculpatory. That, Rubin writes, does not bode well for Trump's chances to avoid conviction when the case goes to trial, likely in a few weeks. Trump, for example, moved to exclude testimony of former fixer Michael Cohen on the ground that Cohen is, quote, a liar. And by the way, that is true. Cohen is a liar. He went to jail for, among other things, lying to federal officials. Of course, when he did so, he was working for Donald Trump, and he did so on behalf of Donald Trump, as his conviction made quite clear, as it referred to Trump at the time as Individual One. Even as Trump escaped prosecution for the crimes that he directed Cohen to carry out on his behalf, thanks to Trump's own attorney general at the time, Bill Barr, largely any investigation and potential prosecution of Trump
you know, was kept from happening entirely. The court in New York rebuked this desperate move, notes Rubin, citing Judge Marchand's ruling, quote, "This court has been unable to locate any treatise, statute, or holding from courts in this jurisdiction or others that support defendants' rationale that a prosecution witness should be kept off the witness stand because his credibility has been previously called into question." Trump's lawyers can, of course, cross-examine Cohen at trial if he's a liar. And by the way, if they were actually worried about him being a liar, it seems to me they would want him to take the stand so they could then tear him apart in cross for being that liar. But for some reason, they really don't want Michael Cohen to testify against Trump, as he apparently effectively also did in the civil fraud case in New York that resulted in a $500 million judgment against his old boss. Trump also trying to keep back evidence of his intent to influence the 2016 election by paying off Stormy Daniels, which is a material part of the case, and of his intent to defraud by describing the payments to Cohen to pay him back for the hush money payments that he gave to Stormy Daniels as being for, quote, legal services. Having already ruled on those issues previously, Judge Marchand scolded Trump's counsel, quote, "Re-arguing this court's prior rulings in this manner is procedurally and professionally inappropriate and a waste of the court's valuable resources." Those motions were denied. Trump also wanted to exclude evidence regarding a meeting in which Cohen and Trump and David Pecker, the guy who used to run the National Enquirer, discussed the catch-and-kill scheme to keep evidence of Trump's sexual transgressions from voters. But that motion also failed.
In other words, he just wants to strike all of the witnesses who were direct witnesses to the wrongdoing.
All of the witnesses, all of the evidence. Trump's tried to exclude the evidence of the Access Hollywood tape, the scandal which actually precipitated Trump's efforts to try to silence women like Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal. Trump's violation of federal campaign finance laws, they want that struck, classification of the hush money as promotional expenses, and much more, all denied, denied, denied. Most important, Rubin asserts, Judge Marchand's refused to exclude more than 100 Trump statements. Yes, stuff that Trump actually said that they don't want to let the jury know about, apparently. Those will not be excluded. In sum, the lion's share of evidence that Trump views as damaging will be heard by the jury. This underscores the quantity and strength of the facts that implicate Trump, argues Rubin. It surely explains why he has been desperate to avoid trial. Even worse for Trump, the judge granted the prosecutor's key motions to exclude evidence and arguments that Trump hoped would sway the jury in his favor. Marchand knocked out most of Trump's experts' potential testimony. He won't get to air his complaint about selective prosecution. That's a big favorite excuse of Trump's. He whines about being singled out by left-wing prosecutors. He will not be able to make that argument in court. He will be barred from offering hearsay evidence about federal prosecutors' opinions about Cohen's credibility and from presenting evidence in support of a reliance on counsel defense. In other words, my attorneys told me to do it. They told me I could do all this criming. Rubin says it's hard to see how the proceedings could have gone any worse for Trump. Although commentators critical of Bragg have knocked his case as, quote, novel, Judge Marchand found otherwise. The upshot is that Bragg will get to put on his case with evidence that he thinks will support a guilty verdict. The jury will not hear some of Trump's familiar excuses. Marchand, writes Rubin, showed himself to be a serious judge who will not indulge Trump's antics nor allow the trial to devolve into a spectacle. Well, we'll see about that part. The case will be tried on straightforward law, Rubin argues, and on the mound of evidence that Bragg has accumulated. Based on these rulings, Trump should be quaking in his boots, she says. Do you think he is?
Yes.
I think so, too. Quick break, and we're back with Desi Doyen and our latest Green News Report right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Late. We're always late. So let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
This is all about reducing emissions and, by that measure, slowing climate change.
EPA issues new tailpipe emissions rules, the most significant climate regulation in U.S. history. Exxon CEO blames the victim, says climate change is your fault. Plus,
this annual report shows that the climate crisis is the defining challenge that humanity faces.
UN Weather Agency issues red alert in new State of the Climate report.
All of those alerts and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The history your company has in climate denial, misinformation, on how do you address that history?
Where we are today is how can we contribute to a solution set, not debate the past.
Yeah, I guess you don't want to debate the past, Darren Woods, ExxonMobil CEO. I wouldn't want to do that either if I were you. This is your Green News Report. Well, the liars keep on lying, Desi Doyen, especially over at ExxonMobil. What do you got for us today?
Well, first, record heat and humidity in Brazil. This week, the city of Rio de Janeiro recorded an astonishing heat index. That's the combined feels-like temperature of heat and humidity, hitting 144 degrees Fahrenheit.
What? 144 degrees?
Fahrenheit. Stifling heat has spread across South America, causing massive wildfires in Chile and Argentina. Meanwhile, the UN World Meteorological Organization issued a, quote, red alert in its State of the Climate report released this week. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres announced the stark findings.
Sirens are blaring across all major indicators. Last year saw record heat, record sea levels, and record ocean surface temperatures. Glaciers likely lost more ice than ever before. Some records are just chart-topping. They are chart-busting.
The report warns that the impacts of man-made climate change are accelerating, driven by humanity's burning of fossil fuels. It cites rising ocean acidification, marine heat waves, and the documented increase in the frequency and intensity of storms, wildfires, floods, and droughts, and heat waves in every country. The report finds some hope in the accelerating deployment of renewable energy globally, but it warns that so far, efforts to cut greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change are inadequate.
Not much hope in Brazil, where it feels like 144 degrees. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble getting that out of my head.
And the CEO of oil giant Exxon says that's all your fault for continuing to use fossil fuels.
Uh-huh.
Exxon is among the top contributors to global planet-heating greenhouse gas emissions. But in a recent Rare media interview, Exxon CEO Darren Woods said the oil industry will continue producing fossil fuels regardless of the impact as long as there is demand. He brushed aside investigations proving that Exxon executives knew for decades that burning fossil fuels would cause the catastrophic impact we are seeing today.
Well, we don't want to talk about the past.
He omitted Exxon's decades of funding climate science denial groups and politicians to sow doubt about climate science, thwart regulations, and prevent alternatives. Woods says the world is not on track to reach net zero emissions in 2050. Because of consumers.
The dirty secret that nobody talks about is how much is all this going to cost and who's willing to pay for it. And the people who are generating the emissions need to be aware of and pay the price for that, for generating those emissions. That's ultimately how you solve the problem.
You're the ones who are generating the emissions. You're the ones who are lying about it. You're the ones who keep digging up the oil and the gas and selling it to the world and killing us all. What are you talking about, Darren Woods?
And of course, the public pays for all of the climate damages. Finally, some good news. The Biden Environmental Protection Agency on Wednesday issued new tailpipe pollution standards for new cars and light trucks for model years 2027 to 2032 that are said to be the most significant regulations to address climate change ever in the U.S. The new rules will reduce demand for oil, significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, and slash toxic air pollution that causes heart attacks, respiratory diseases, and premature death. The new rules ensure that most new cars will be electric or plug-in hybrids by 2032, and they'll deliver an estimated $100 billion in net public health benefits from cleaner air. Republican-controlled states and fossil fuel industry groups are expected to sue to stop the new rules.
I don't understand why they would. I would think Darren Woods, ExxonMobil CEO, would be delighted about this new rule. For some reason, I'm guessing he's not. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. We'll be off for spring break next week. We'll see you thereafter. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Well, I know you've got your own version of the truth. There's only three things left now that I can do.
That's it.
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. As you heard the man say there, we will be taking off the next week for our spring break. We will see you after the holidays. But don't worry. I arranged for there to be no primary elections over the next week, for there to be no Trump trials over the next week. Yes, that was my handiwork.
You're welcome.
although it kind of should be crazy when it comes to what happens for that $500 million. Anyway, all of that. When we get back, we need a break here. My thanks again to Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download them, as always, for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit one of those donate buttons or to go straight to bradblog.com/donate. To help us stay on your public airwaves. It is greatly appreciated. Thank you in advance, and thank you if you've already done so. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at the Brad Blog and Desi Doyen at
Green News Report. Come by and say hi.
That's it. We'll see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.